Good evening, everyone. I was trying to delay a few minutes. I know our Mayor Pro Tem is en route and will be here any moment.
And we pray for your guidance in this meeting tonight, that decisions will be made in harmony with your will. We pray all these things in your name. Amen.
Well, Pastor, before you get too far away, thank you very much for being here tonight. We appreciate it. Hope you'll come back and do it again for us. Okay. Terry, you're an old-timer here. You know the drill. We get to hear about Lions Club.
That's right. And thank you very much. The things that we've been doing here recently, we did a barbecue for the cancer survivors through the Palchak Foundation, and that's always a lot of fun to see the people come, hopefully every year, and we put on a pretty good feed for them. Turkey Trot, which you, of course, know very well because that's one that you represent. We also are very involved with that. We donate the money for the turkeys and the game hens and that sort of thing. And also we try to help out, too, and we really enjoy that one. And, of course, coming up is the basketball for boys and girls will be coming up in this month and next month, too. So that's pretty much what we're up to right now, just that sort of thing. So thank you.
Well, we appreciate all the good work, so thanks very much. Okay, moving along on the agenda, item 5 is agenda review. 5A are closed session announcements. We have none this evening. 5B, move that all ordinances presented for introduction or adoption be read in title only and all further readings be waived.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. Moving on to item 6, special presentations. We do indeed have several presentations this evening, and I'm very pleased and proud to make those presentations. Just to give you some quick background, you'll note that on the agenda we're going to be taking up the issue of becoming a charter city later this evening. But before we get to that, I want to recognize our Charter City's Citizen Advisory Committee. Several members from that committee are in the audience this evening. Last July, the council determined that we would move forward with a public process of examining the issue of whether to become a charter city. And our first action was to form a Citizen Advisory Committee. And that committee began meeting in March of 2013. They held a total of 7 meetings. Those meetings were publicly noticed. Members of the public spoke in front of those meetings. The committee chair was Judith Bean. She's here this evening. And the vice chair is John Keane. He's also here this evening. This committee has finished a significant portion of its work. They were tasked with submitting recommendations to the council, much of what we will discuss later on this evening. But right now I want to step down from the dais and recognize each of them. And the way I'd like to do it is that we have some awards that we would like to present, and then we're going to do a picture up here. So what I'm going to do is ask, I'll call each by name, present the plaque, and then if you would please remain up here. And then just to give you a heads up, Judith, we may ask you to say a few words if you choose. Okay. Knowing that you've never been at a loss for words, so. I'm going to read these names. I know you're going to want to applaud for them, but if you'd hold your applause until the end, and then we'll recognize them as a group. Thomas Goss. Tom? Patricia Hardy. Bob Lund. John Keane. Zachary Hall. Randy Steiger. And Judith Bean. And Andrea Montes.
And can we get the council maybe to stand in the background?
Oh, can I stand on the table?
See me. Stand on the table.
Yeah, that's me.
Does anybody have a box for Christian?
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to take a couple of seconds to say that it was a daunting task. We had a large committee and a bunch of different points of view, and really what made it all work was that we got a lot of information from city staff ahead of time. They were extremely responsive to our needs and to our requests, and we had a packet of information this big to go through. We had great discussions, and everybody treated each other with respect and dignity, and we made some tough decisions, but in the end, I think we really enjoyed ourselves, and I know you should be proud of your city staff. I know you are, and we are too, because they really helped. Make it easy for us. Thanks.
Judith, you know, one thing I wanted to note, and I'm sure the rest of the council will agree in reviewing the staff report and looking at the specific work that you did, it was an incredible amount of detail. And we are really so very grateful for your commitment and the depth of your involvement in this issue. It was really tremendously helpful. So thank you so much. Thanks to everyone.
Thank
much
you.
Much appreciated. So. And our Mayor Pro Tem has joined us. Jim, good evening. Okay, we're going to move on to item 7, community comments and suggestions. This is an opportunity for members of the public to come forward and comment on items that are not on this evening's agenda. The Brown Act restricts the council from taking any action on matters not posted on the agenda. We would ask that you keep your comments brief, 3 minutes or less, and once again, items not on this evening's agenda. Please address the council as one body. Anyone who would like to come forward, community comments and suggestions, anyone? Please come to the microphone, and if we could get your name, please.
Happy New Year. Mark Lewis. And I'm an Arroyo Grande resident living at the southern end of South Halcyon, where they recently repaved the road. And prior to doing that, I had expressed concerns over speed at the southern end of South Halcyon as it enters the city limits, where there was a crosswalk, where people walked their kids to school. After paving, the crosswalk wasn't repainted according to the police chief's ideas. It was not a good spot. They're going to replace the crosswalk and put in the flashing beacon, like the ones that they put in at the high school. And I'd like to say respectfully that without speed controls in place, it's not going to do much good to put any kind of crosswalk on Halcyon. There's a number of issues with striping and pedestrian signs that will indicate to people entering the city limit that there's a speed zone approaching and a school zone and crosswalks. Let's see. They removed the crosswalk after a public comment period and didn't repaint it after paving, and they removed the pedestrian crossing signs, as a matter of fact. And shortly after that, about a month later, a neighborhood resident was hit by a car on Halcyon, 50 feet or so from one of the removed pedestrian crossing signs. So my main thrust is that the new crosswalk with the flashing beacon should be delayed until the flashing beacon, at least, until a study is conducted to find out where the main traffic is from the high school and from the elementary school, and also just to increase the number of pedestrian crossing signs and to try reducing the speed of cars leaving Halcyon before they reach the city limit.
Thank you for your comments. Steve, perhaps you can follow up, and if you can at some point give some contact information to our city manager if he doesn't have it already. Cynthia, your chair is open here if you choose to use it. Okay, we're going to move on to item 8, the consent agenda. If you're following along this evening, we're going to be addressing consent items 8A through 8P, Paul. And this is normally a group of items that the council approves in one motion unless there is an item on consent that a member of the council would like to pull for further discussion, clarification, or an independent action. This is also an opportunity for members of the public to come forward and comment on any of the agenda items. So once again, if you're following along and there's an agenda item, 8A through 8P, if anyone would like to come forward and comment on any of those items, this would be an opportunity for you to do so. Once again, please keep your comments brief and address the council as one body. Anyone who would like to come forward on consent? Okay, seeing no one, we will close a public comment on the consent agenda, and we will bring this to the council. What is the will of the council this evening? Any items to pull?
No.
Okay, very good. I'll entertain a motion then to approve the consent agenda.
So moved.
Second.
All right, we have a motion to approve consent agenda items 8A through 8P and a second. Tim, anything to read in there this evening?
No ordinances this evening, Mr.
Okay.
Mayor.
Thank you very much. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Varnish?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes. Okay, moving along. We're on item 9, public hearings, and 9A. is a consideration of a proposed city charter ballot measure. Steve?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. It is my pleasure this evening to present to you the recommendations of the City Charter Advisory Committee. As you know, after holding two public hearings in 2012 to review a draft charter, the City Council delayed proceeding at that time in order to obtain more public involvement. A citizen city charter advisory committee was then formed, and in order to provide recommendations on the charter and on whether or not to proceed. The makeup of the committee was designed to provide broad community representation, which included 11 members. As you mentioned, Judith Bean served as the chair, and John Keane served as the vice chair. They held a total of 7 meetings. All the meetings fell under the Brown Act, were publicly noticed, and were all well attended by the public, who provided a variety of public input at each of the meetings. The committee used the draft charter as a base document to work from, and then walked through each section and agreed on a number of proposed changes to the document. Not all of the decisions were unanimous, but there was some pretty strong consensus. And at the conclusion of the process, the committee recommended that the City Council proceed with the process of placing a charter measure on the ballot at the November 4th, 2014 election. I'd like to provide just a very quick summary for the benefit of the public on the background. Once again, there are two types of cities in California. There's general law cities and charter cities. Arroyo Grande is currently a general law city. A charter is kind of a set of bylaws, and the benefit of being a charter city is that it provides the city some additional autonomy from the state on areas that have been determined to be municipal affairs by either the state legislature or the Supreme Court. As a result of that, more and more cities are becoming charter cities. There are now over 120 in California, which translates to over 25% of cities in California. So the City Charter Advisory Committee approved recommending a charter to the council that basically includes six primary changes from the most recent draft charter that the City Council had reviewed. I'd like to walk through these with you quickly, and you have each copies of the document with all the changes redlined marked in them to show them clearly, but I'll just summarize them very clearly. Or very quickly, sorry. First of all, there was language added to the preamble of the document emphasizing the goal of preserving the city's agricultural heritage and historical character, state public works contract code, primarily so we don't have to establish all our own policies and procedures. So once again, instead of recommending to exempt the city from the entire public works contract code, the committee instead developed and recommended language that exempts the city from only those specific areas that they felt would be beneficial to the city. And those include the ability to establish the city's only own criteria for the award of contract bids, the ability to accept donations and contributions of labor and materials, and three, the ability to utilize in-house staff and coordinate with other public agencies to construct public works projects. Next, the language in the prevailing wage section of the charter, which specified that the city would not pay prevailing wage on contracts except in certain circumstances, was recommended to be replaced with language instead granting the City Council the authority to develop or establish guidelines and criteria for determining when payment of prevailing wage on contracts would apply. By doing that, then the question regarding prevailing wage really changes from not a question of whether prevailing wage should be required or not, but under this language, the real question is simply, should that decision be made by the state legislature, or should the decision be made by the City Council? So under this language, the council would be given flexibility and to potentially utilize that to determine there may be circumstances where prevailing wage is appropriate, and there may be other circumstances where we determine that it's not cost efficient. But the purpose is to provide the council that council flexibility to be able to determine when and how we can make our operations most cost efficient. Lastly, language was added to address SB 7. The last time that the City Council considered the draft charter, you'll recall that one of the primary concerns was the ongoing State Supreme Court Vista case, which was later decided and concluded that prevailing wage is a municipal affair and charter cities have the right to determine that. However, then, in what appears to be a very clear attempt to get around the court ruling, the state legislature passed SB 7, which prohibits any charter city from receiving any state funds if they have a provision in their charter that allows contractors not to pay prevailing wage on public works contracts, even if that project is fully paid for from local funds. So as a result of that, there are efforts now underway by a number of cities and the League of California Cities to contest that bill in court, which we believe and our legal counsel strongly believes will be found to be invalid due to that clear conflict with the recent state Supreme Court case. So as a result, the additional language added clarifies that the prevailing wage provisions in the charter will only take effect when and if SB 7 is found to be invalid. That special language would also be deleted from the charter at that time. So one of the key questions for council to consider is, do we want to delay until the deliberation on SB 7 is decided, or do we want to move forward and try to get the charter in place now with the understanding that the prevailing wage provisions would not take effect until and if SB 7 is struck down, which is what the committee has recommended to you. Now, there was recently a mailer was sent out to all Arroyo Grande residents in opposition of the charter, which made a number of claims regarding what are, you know, some common concerns of charters. Unfortunately, though, the information was inaccurate, and I felt it was important to clear that up this evening for the benefit of the public. So first of all, the proposed charter will not provide the City Council with any additional authority to increase their compensation, because there's a clause in the draft charter that specifically states that City Council compensation will be set by state law applicable to general law cities. It's also kind of just an interesting note for the public's benefit that the City Council's compensation hasn't been adjusted in any ways for almost 15 years, which means their current salaries are well below what's allowed for general law cities, which means if they wanted to increase to appropriate $25,000 for a contract for a public opinion survey, but staff is not recommending that at this time. Now, I mentioned that the decisions of the committee were not unanimous, and so there was some discussion of options, and we've tried to include provide information on those in your staff report. I'll summarize those now. First of all, there was some concern regarding language actually added by the council in the draft charter that specifies that the City Council cannot by ordinance establish any additional powers, rights, and responsibilities beyond what is expressly described in the charter. So the purpose of that was to try and address any concerns the public might have regarding authority granted by the charter that could be abused at some time in the future. However, the downside to that language is it really reduces the benefit of being a charter city, because it precludes the city from being able to avoid new state requirements imposed by the state legislature later on that may fall under the categories of municipal affairs unless they are already specifically spelled out in the city's charter. So one alternative is to remove that language from the charter. Secondly, obviously, there was a lot of discussion regarding prevailing wage by the committee and a number of alternatives tossed around that the council could consider. The prevailing wage provision could be left out of the charter. The prevailing wage provisions could be separated out as a separate measure and voted on separately at the same election. Or the prevailing wage provisions could be separated out as a separate measure at a subsequent election after SB 7 is hopefully resolved. And then, of course, the council can make other changes to language within the charter and have the option of deciding not to proceed at this time. So just to conclude, I'd like to just summarize our recommendations. And first of all, I want to emphasize that we are not recommending or the council's not being asked in any way to approve or adopt anything as far as the charter is concerned this evening. What the recommendations are is, one, to hold the public hearing, get public comment, review the recommendations of the committee, provide any directions that you have to staff as far as changes or modifications you'd like to make to the draft charter as we move forward for consideration at the next public hearing. Direct staff to proceed with the process, which means scheduling the next public hearing, and that the process requires two public hearings before the decision is made to place the charter on the ballot. So we'll have at least one more public hearing before that decision takes place. And so there'd be two more meetings overall. As I mentioned, we recommended an appropriation of $10,000 for public education. And then we also provided supplemental information to you, I believe yesterday, regarding an additional clause that was discussed at the committee level and appeared to have been agreed upon and inadvertently was left out of the document that the committee voted on. So we're recommending that be added. And it consists of language that basically specifies that any amendments to the charter have to be voted on by the public. That's the requirement anyway, so it doesn't really change anything, but it does make it much more clear for any people voting on this measure and reading the charter. It'll make it very clear for them what that process is. And so we see some benefit to that. With that, that concludes my presentation, but I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Okay. Questions for Steve? Why don't we start to my right, and we'll just move this way.
Okay.
Councilmember Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. My question is not so much for Steve as probably for legal counsel, and I think I probably had this conversation. One of the issues that comes up in this is the contrast between a general law city and a charter city, and the issue is a general law city has certain the ability to operate under certain guidelines as granted by the state constitution. And I have to admit, when I looked in the state constitution, I couldn't find anything referring to that. So maybe, Tim, you could explain again exactly what the difference is between the general law city and the charter city in terms of what the constitution provides.
We're lucky to have David Hirsch here tonight, who actually is the expert on this subject and advised the Charter Advisory Committee. So I'm going to turn most questions over to David, unless he turns them back to me.
Well, actually, general law cities are empowered under the state constitution to use some of those things if you'd like. It's kind of a laundry list kind of thing at this point. But those are the main differences.
I don't think you need to go into the laundry list. That's a pretty good explanation for what I was looking for. And that's the question I have.
Okay. Councilmember Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I guess, Steve, my question would go to both you and the committee. I know we talked about this a little bit, and that is, if SB 7 is not struck down, what is some of the better values of having a charter city? Because that's one of the things we're going to have to educate the public on, and I want to have a clear picture of that. And I've just got reservations about depending on which way that SB 7 goes.
I'll make a couple comments, and maybe Tim can add on to this because we both discussed this and have different ideas and things. The first point I'd like to make, though, is as I know I've received a lot of questions. I've received that specific question many times, and I just want to begin by emphasizing that nothing's guaranteed, but all the legal analysis we've received has been pretty positive that the consistent consistent prediction is that SB 7 will be struck down because it's so clearly contradictory to the Supreme Court decision. So that was a big basis for why we recommended proceeding the way we were. If it was like a 50-50 prediction, we might have approached this differently. So that's the first step, but that doesn't answer your question. Let me just move on. So as far as other items, because there is no guarantee that will be the outcome, I think the most significant benefit is the other public works contracting items. Most beneficial is to be able to establish our own criteria for awarding contracts. You've probably often heard criticisms of the system that government has to use where we have to accept the low bidder, which doesn't necessarily mean we wouldn't be still continuing to accept the low bidder, but the difference would be we could come up with much more stringent criteria on being able to disqualify bidders that have had poor performance in the past, where the state process does not allow that to any great extent. It's very difficult under the state system to qualify bidders that we know have had poor performance in the past. So that's a pretty big deal to us. The other items within that public works contract code in terms of accepting labor and materials and contributions from contractors that may be participating in a community project, the ability to utilize our in-house staff more. So there could be we wouldn't be using our own staff to do significantly large projects, but sometimes there's some medium-sized projects that we're not allowed to do, and if we had the staff to do it, that could be much more cost-efficient. I think most of our goals in doing this is increasing cost efficiency. Tim, things you'd like to add to that?
The two other most conspicuous that are remaining in the draft charter are the use of volunteer labor, which is sometimes problematic under the current law, hard to believe, but true. And then the use of mail-in ballots for special elections, which can really reduce costs substantially and in some instances expedite the process. And that couldn't be used to amend the charter itself, but in all other instances it could. So there are other benefits, less conspicuous, but those are the major ones that we can identify.
While you have the mic, let me ask you a question. What's the chance of this being fast-tracked in terms of the litigation on this issue going up?
Hard to say. In any instance, you can assume it's going to be a year or more, more like a year plus, before you're going to see any finality on the issue. And David has a better handle on what's going on internally.
I just wanted to add to what Tim just said in that respect, and that is, given the nature of the issue, it's also clear to me that this is only going to be resolved when it gets to the state Supreme Court. So a lower appellate opinion is not going to be the end-all, be-all, and that just means it's going to take more time to resolve.
I guess my last question dovetails into that, and it's given the kind of unknown state of that issue, how do you see the education of the public going forward in terms of how do we explain that issue going forward if we're trying to get people to move in a positive direction? And that's been difficult for me to figure out how to do that.
As far as the language we have in the charter, considering it's a little bit complicated, given that it's contingent upon,
how do you get people that are going to the ballot box and don't pay close attention to every single
one under the public works contracts? The first item that talks about lowest responsible and most reliable bidder, what you were just speaking about. That we can have some guidelines for who we hire if there's been poor quality work in the past. Now that speaks to whether we leave the prevailing wage provisions in the charter or not, correct?
Could you repeat that? I'm not sure I followed.
Okay. On section 301,
uh-huh.
In the staff report you talk about one of the benefits of the charter is that it would better enable the city to reject bids from contractors with a history of low-quality work. And I think that speaks right to the item I. City Council may, by ordinance, establish criteria for determining the award of public works contracts to the lowest responsible and most reliable bidder. So my question is whether we go forward and we leave the provisions for prevailing wage in the charter, that would stay in there. That would speak to both.
You can maintain these items under the public works contract without having the prevailing wage.
But if prevailing wage was in there, this would not speak to that, right? Because that sort of negates.
Sounds like Tim.
Yeah, you're correct. This is a standalone provision, unrelated to prevailing wage. Although the language, and we'll probably have to talk about this a little if this is the direction that you go, there is some cluttering language in there that, in the very end of 301I. It refers to including but not limited to the compensation rates to be paid for the performance of such work, mm-hmm. Which is a little bit confusing. David and I just had a discussion about this. prevailing wage provisions are included in the labor code. This section deals with the public contracts code, so effectively you couldn't reach prevailing wage through 301 because it limits you to modifying the public contracts code. That language is apparently a holdover from some other drafts and provisions, and I think you'll notice that the provision 307 that deals with SB 7, and that is essentially it says until it's clarified and there's a final determination on it, these can't go into effect. It also refers to 301 primarily for that reason, because there's a reference to the compensation rates to be paid for the performance of work, which is a prevailing wage issue. And it's somewhat circular, but we'd recommend, depending on what direction you go, that you eliminate that language from that section to clarify that it in no way deals with prevailing wage. And prevailing wage is going to be dealt with exclusively in 302. But getting back to your question, those provisions that deal with bidding, award, and performance of public contracts are unrelated to the prevailing wage issue.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem, you had a question?
Just to clarify, under the criteria, we could use a whole set of criteria, including whether we might give some advantage to local bidders and those kinds of things as well.
Yes, although we do have a provision that deals with local preferences in our code now. We could beef it up and probably extend it far beyond where we have it now.
I just wanted to verify. Thank you.
I had a quick question, Steve. Coming back to, I think, one of your alternatives regarding some of the language that restricts the council in the establishment of ordinances, and specifically, it's under Article 1, and it's in the draft that we have in front of us in red. Provided, however, that the City Council may not establish by ordinance any powers, rights, and responsibilities that are not either expressly described in this charter or allowed by state law applicable to general law cities. That's the language that you were discussing that originated from us. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So what does that do to our ability if the legislature were to pass something that is not specifically outlined in our charter but is clearly a municipal affair? And this issue has come up with the League, and the example that has been used is, and it's going to be coming back on this ballot, we suspect, in November in some way, shape, or form, the medical marijuana issue. If the state overturns local authority to ban them, and there are more and more cities now banning them altogether because of...
There was an extensive discussion explore and discuss the fact that this is a bit different than what you find in most charters. Most charters simply reserve the ability to... regulate in those areas that are deemed to be a municipal affair, whether it's specifically addressed in the charter or not. That right is reserved. And in this instance, language had been included that undercut that by essentially saying that all that can be dealt with is what's in the charter. And there are certainly some areas that are municipal affairs that are addressed in this document, but there could be others in the future, since it's a fluid concept, since what constitutes a municipal affair is decided on a case-by-case basis by the courts, there could be things in the future, or there may be other things that the City Council would want to do that they couldn't do because of this more limiting language. So the Charter Advisory Committee did have a very full discussion of that issue and ultimately decided that they wanted to see that language maintained in the document.
Okay. Well, we'll save that discussion for later, but that clearly is a concern for me. I can understand the language that limits us in those areas that historically have been abused, and I think that's what we're after here. but at the same time, we don't want to limit us to limit our ability to, in fact, do what the spirit of the charter was intended to do. I'm finding it difficult to imagine how we would capture every potential event in the charter that we could come across, particularly not with this legislature. I don't have any other questions, but I'm thinking at this juncture, I was going to save this until later, but I think it would be beneficial, I know for the council, there have been several questions on SB 7. And so what I wanted to do was give you the most recent information that we have from the League. And I spoke with our general counsel from the League of Cities today. And you all know the background on SB 7. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. The main issue that we have is the fact that SB 7 prohibits not using prevailing wage, even in situations where we pay for a local project ourselves with our own money. As Steve indicated, the city of Vista won their lawsuit. The Supreme Court did make a judgment in their favor on this issue. Where we are right now with it is that three cities so far have joined the effort with the League and have indicated an interest to be named as plaintiffs. We have four cities that will be lining up with the League of Cities to provide funding for the legal costs associated with this. We are moving forward with preparing briefs. Those briefs will be filed early February. And I think on the funding issue, there were at least 10 other cities that were presenting the issue of supplemental funding for this particular effort to their councils. And so we expect more cities to join as we move forward. But the League is facilitating this effort. It is moving forward. The briefs will be filed. Part of the I think the criticality of this is recognizing that one of the requirements in the lower courts is going to be a stay. And if there is not a stay for this to go into effect, and it's scheduled to go into effect January of 2015, if there's not a stay in the lower courts, the League will immediately file what's known as a facial challenge on the constitutionality and take it directly to the Supreme Court. That's where we are right now. I have not talked to any legal body who feels that SB 7 will remain valid. So I don't know if that helps, but that's where we are to date. Okay, any other questions? Yes.
Just one question on the specific language or where the council becomes the decider on prevailing wage. Has that ever been used before? Do you know of another example where a community has a charter city and the council, I'm going to say on an ongoing basis, is reevaluating prevailing wage? I mean, do we have another example?
Before, regarding the powers established by the ordinance, when we discussed it originally, I don't think I fully understood what that meant. And when I did, I changed my mind on whether it should be included in the charter, because I think really it boils down to if you leave it in, it limits the city's ability to react to things that come up in the future. And because we have more flexibility as a charter city than a general law city, I think we want to be able to take action when we need to take action through an ordinance or a resolution. And if you leave it as it is now, we won't have that flexibility. But I want to say that the Royal Grande Chamber of Commerce and Royal Grande Grover Beach Chamber of Commerce is fully in support of Royal Grande and Grover Beach becoming a charter city. And should you move forward with it, we pledge to give our support in helping get the word out to residents in any way that we can. you know, as I said, we were really diverse and there were a lot of different points of view, but in the end, our decision to recommend proceeding with the charter city was nearly unanimous, and something I wouldn't have foreseen 6 months earlier into the process. But I think it all boils down to whether we trust our citizens to make the decisions with the best interest of our community, or whether we feel comfortable letting Sacramento do that for us. So I hope you move forward with it. Thanks.
Thanks so much again. Okay, we're going to open up the public hearing portion of this. I would like to invite members of the public to come forward. Once again, please limit your comments to 3 minutes or less. Please state your name when you come to the podium. Please address the council as one body. Okay, we'll start off.
Thank you, Mayor Ferreira, Council. My name is Russell Johnson. I'm with the Associated Builders and Contractors. And if you look on the second page I handed you, it tells you a little bit briefly about us. ABC is a workforce construction development organization. We have our training facility, which is pictured in the picture in your presentation before you. And we train the workforce of tomorrow. Our member companies are contractors. And our contractor members are merit shop contractors. Merit shop is a fancy way of saying non-union contractors. So as you weigh your decision tonight as to whether or not to proceed with a city charter or not, I want to congratulate your city on the efforts you have made so far and on the yeoman's work that your committee performed, because it is truly a lot that they went through, and they had to get educated on some very important issues. First, when we get into what is a charter, I'm going to highlight for you that charter cities are a unique governmental entity that is different than any other governmental entity in the state. Counties don't have the same powers they have. Special districts don't have those powers. Water districts don't. It's only charter cities. A charter is basically a constitution for your community. It enables your city to avail themselves of the rights that are granted under the California State Constitution. It gives cities power over municipal affairs and a greater level of local control. Charters do not need to list every power, but they need to say that you guys are going to have jurisdiction over municipal affairs. Included in the presentation I gave you is the Article 9, Section 5 of the California State Constitution, which enumerates the powers specifically just to charter cities and why they have this right over municipal affairs, or what's often called to as home rule. As was stated aptly by your staff, the courts are really the determining factor as to what rights cities have and charter cities have over municipal affairs. Some items that have been reserved are municipal election matters, land use and zoning decisions, how a city spends its taxpayer dollars, and municipal contracts. So you're probably asking yourself, why are cities looking at becoming charter cities? One, greater independence from Sacramento. It doesn't solve all your problems. It doesn't give you all the flexibility you need. But on the things that matter, where you can have that autonomy, you get that ability to do so. Rights of charter cities are expanding. The City of Vista decision that just came down. There was also a decision that came down involving the City of San Diego, I believe in August 12th of 2013, at a lower court. But as you go along, courts are expanding the rights of charter cities. And you've never had a charter city, at least to my knowledge. Once you become one, you typically don't go back to being a general law city. You stay being a charter. And cities are looking at becoming charter cities because they want to be poised to capture those benefits. Well, Arroyo Grande should be first, and Sacramento should be second. Provisions that you put your day first and Sacramento second. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Anyone else who would like to come forward?
Good evening, Mayor, City Council, staff, and public. My name is Steve Weiner. I'm the Executive Secretary Treasurer of the Tri-Counties Building Construction Trades Council. I represent the craft unions in the three counties, Ventura, Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo County. First comment is going to be about my good friend Russell Johnson when he talked about the ABC. Just for your information, the ABC represents a quarter of all the contractors in California, but yet they make up 24% of all the labor violations in the state of California. So, you know, you take that when you hear what he has to say. As for the training that he was talking about, union labor management training programs graduate over 70% of their apprentices to become journeymen. ABC contractors and their apprenticeship program are in single digits when it comes to graduation for the training. So just a couple of little things. You know, we train the workforce of the future. Now, for the charter, public contracting code, why do you think that came about? Because people were cheating. People were taking advantage of other people. That's how the public contracting laws came about. And what you want to do is try to do away with them and start over. I think that's a mistake. As for prevailing wages, you want to get this charter passed, have strong language in there that you will support prevailing wages and pay prevailing wages on all projects, and I guarantee you this charter will pass. If not, then there is going to be a fight. And I would rather be with you people and help you get this charter passed, because there are some good points that has been brought up in the committee and staff has brought up why you need a charter. So we're here to say that we're willing to help you get a charter passed, but we want strong language in there on prevailing wages. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Anyone else?
How are you doing tonight? I represent the Carpenters Local 1800 out of Rio Grande.
Could I get your name, please?
Oh, sorry, Brent Jenkins.
I'm sorry.
Brent Jenkins. You know, we have a lot of guys who, in the area, a lot of local carpenters. You know, we represent a lot of these local carpenters. We get a lot of flack for coming to some of the city council meetings and some of the local guys not being here to represent themselves. Well, you know, a lot of those guys are out working and coming home late. So that's why we're here, just so some of these guys know that's what we're doing. Now, on to some of this stuff, you know, I'm no pro on the charter cities thing, on the charter city thing, but I'm just kind of getting acquainted with it. But from what I do know, there are some good points, but the prevailing wage issue is a huge issue. You know, thanks to some of the prevailing wages, the construction workers are getting paid good wages to live in this area. As you guys know, this is not a cheap place to live. So, you know, we also provide health care, and pension benefits for everybody. Another thing would be prevailing wages make it possible to have a quality training programs. We train our guys, you know, to the best of our abilities. If you've ever seen one of the training centers that we put together, you know, they're incredible. You know, these guys put tons of money into training to make sure that they work safely, they do their job correctly. You know, these other other companies, they don't. That's not their concern. You know, we're about training. We're about safety. We want to make sure that these guys come home, you know, to the families at night. So, the prevailing wage helps us do that. You know, it keeps that sort of thing going. When you take that away, all you're going to get is these fly by night companies coming in here and you know, trashing on their guys and sending them home broken, with no pension, no health benefits. Prevailing wage is about fairness. All contractors pay the same wage and compete fairly so they don't bring down the industry. Huge problem with the industry right now with people undercutting each other to just to get ahead, you know. And when workers are paid good wages, they have more money to spend locally. You know, all the money that you guys are going to, that could be taken away with the prevailing wage being taken away, you know, that's money not going back into the community. So you got to take that into consideration. That's a lot of lost money. That's really all I got for right now. I do urge you to vote no against, you know, the prevailing wage piece part of this section. That's mostly what I got.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anyone else? Once again, please try and keep your comments brief.
My name is Walt Mankins. I'm with the Operating Engineers, local union number 12. Buy a new pair of shoes for their kid or do whatever for their family. I urge you guys strongly to keep the prevailing wage intact. I don't care really SB7, if it's found, whether it's found to be good or bad. These people that pay their taxes in this community deserve a good living wage. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your comments.
Hi, I'm Jan Scott. I'm here because Kirk couldn't be present for the vote on this on committee, and he was passionate about prevailing wage, and I told him that if I got a chance, I would tell you. So I'm telling you. Thank you.
Thank you, Jan. Anyone else?
Good evening, Mayor, Council members, and staff. My name is David Kirsch. I'm the Executive Director of the Carpenters Contractors Cooperation Committee. We're a labor management group that's affiliated with the signatory contractors and the Carpenters Union. Just the prevailing wage issues were brought up, but I just want to add one other aspect into this, and it's we deal a lot with the underground economy. A big part of what we do is we do labor compliance, and I think what you're going to end up happening is if you've got cities around here that have prevailing wage and suddenly you don't have prevailing wage here, it's going to be attracting a lot of the contractors that are operating in the underground economy. And I think you're going to get what you pay for. You're going to have the worst contractors that are coming in here. Prevailing wage does not only create a lot of benefits for the workers, but it creates some protection for the city because you have reporting requirements, you have more oversight. So something to consider is that while you think you're going to get more flexibility, you're also going to be sort of the place that attracts all the contractors that don't want to do prevailing wage works, both union and non-union. In regards to just some of the criteria about the bidding process, you can at this point have a pre-qualification process. You can have language there where you can have some more teeth in regards to how you select contractors. While you still have to comply with the public contract code, there are ways in which you can have in your existing contracting procedures, ways in which you just weed out some of the contractors and get more information and more disclosure about their violations or safety issues in order to make a better informed decision. So I urge you, if you're going to move forward, to make sure that you keep the prevailing wage provisions, and I echo the comments from the other members from the trades that, yeah, I mean, if you keep the prevailing wage language there, you're going to get support because there are good things that a charter can provide the city. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else?
Yeah, good evening. I'm David Baldwin. I'm the business rep for the Plasters and Cement Masons Union here in the San Luis Obispo and Santa Maria areas. I'm also a lifelong member of the county here. Born and raised here. I actually went through the apprenticeship program myself, and I'm happy to say that one of the master craftsmen that I apprenticed under is sitting here in the audience, and I'm thankful for everything that he passed on to me so that I could make a living, and now I'm a rep for the union. And, you know, I guess I can go down the list. I've been here before, you know, and I can go down the list of why it's hurtful to exempt prevailing wages to the craft workers that build your roads and bridges here in the city. You know, the increase in on-the-job injuries, increase in cost overruns, the shoddy workmanship, and in addition to the local workforce being undercut, over time what you see is you see that the local tradespeople, the expert craftsmen, become less and less skilled without the apprenticeship training. There's no formal apprenticeship training requirement when you get rid of the prevailing wage requirement. And this is important because over time you want to make sure that you continue to train the workforce of tomorrow. You heard some of the others speak about their training programs. They're very important, and the state recognizes this, and rightfully so. At best, without the apprenticeship training, you know, you're going to get some haphazard training, and maybe a few guys will get some training, but it certainly won't be to the extent that is necessary to maintain a skilled workforce. So, you know, to summarize, I guess I'm just asking you to do the right thing. It, you know, you can't hurt some of the people in the city in an effort to try to help the people in the city. It doesn't feel right. It doesn't sound right. It just doesn't make sense. And
take a stand which way I think anything should go. My main point for speaking tonight is the $10,000 appropriation for public education. I teach school at night, and I know that misinformation or opinion sometimes can send us in the wrong direction, whatever direction that might be. I would implore the City Council to be rigorous in expending my tax dollars and the tax dollars of my neighbors on anything that isn't actually accurate. I would hate to see tax money be spent on something with an agenda. Now, it's easy to sit on the sidelines and criticize people that try to do good works in this community. That's easy to do. I don't believe in that. I'd like to help be a force to get work done to help the community. If there is an additional workload that is required to do some good fact-checking before we send out information, I would like to volunteer my time and service to the community so that I'm just not here saying what you should do. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, we never turn away volunteers, so make sure we have all your contact information. Okay, next speaker, please.
Steve Ross, 211 Garden Street. I live in Arroyo Grande. I wonder how many of the people here speaking for their agencies live in Arroyo Grande. I would say probably not all or even many. I believe that if there's state money involved or federal money involved, prevailing wage kicks in regardless of whether we're a charter city or not. People talk about how the taxes are paid and stuff like that. This extra money that's getting paid to the workers are coming out of our taxes. So our taxes are paying those. So our taxes are higher because we have to pay prevailing wage. I disagree with the fact that there are not talented and concerned and good quality construction installation individuals and companies that are non-union and do better work than some unions might. I've had experience where we had union picket our job site because we did not have union installers. And in a city of 500,000 people, the union could not provide a single trained installer or even an apprentice installer. We had to deal with people who had no idea what the job would be. So not all training is provided by unions. I think one of the biggest problems with having to live under the prevailing wage type acts is something that I can bring home to the community and something that we're doing here and now. The Ladies Club is trying to raise money to remodel the kitchen at the Women's Center. And there are people who are contractors and material suppliers who are willing to provide workers and materials at their cost. But because we're a law city, we cannot accept that. And because we're a law city, anything that goes out to bid, even if the city is paying a small portion and the rest of the money is being raised locally, we would still have to go out to bid, which costs a lot of money when you're dealing with prevailing wage, especially in paperwork. So we are taking those people who want to give something to the city and telling them, no, you can't because of the law. I think that's a real problem. I don't believe that we need to have unions training all the people. I don't believe that they train everybody to do the best job. The city is already trying to put into the charter that we would base our acceptance of bid not on the lowest bid, but on the lowest bid we received from a recognized contractor or entity that we know does good work already. So it provides us with that ability and not to have to pay prevailing wage or take the lowest bid that we received. I think that we need to look at other things just besides the union issue and look at the things that people in the community can provide to the city once the prevailing wage for city-sponsored projects is...
The main thing that I wanted to express to this group. Thank you.
Thanks for your comments. Anyone else?
Good evening. John Keene, 298 North Elm Street. Was a member of the committee, and I thought it was handled and very fair of all our discussions and input. I think we came up with a very good draft, and I'm in favor of being a charter city. I have some problems with the labor wage part of the draft. As I was going through the draft today, I still found a couple of things that I was the wording is a little strange and the words themselves. And just as an example, in 101 on page 10, right at the last sentence, repeal, amend, change, or suspend by proper authority. Who's the proper authority? Is the city council the proper authority? Is that what the proper authority means?
John, say that again, please.
Where's that?
What section, John?
101. You made a comment about...
Yeah, it's 101, but it's on the next page, page 10. It's up the top, and it's the very last sentence on the first paragraph. And I just want to make sure that proper authority is referring to the council.
Okay.
One of the reasons that I really initially became a fan of charter cities was Section 401, the mandate limitation thing, and I think that's really important to make sure that. I'm glad that's in there because that's a section that tells us that we can or we don't have to do mandates that aren't funded from the state. And I think that's one of the interesting ones and probably the most important one to me right now, other than of course the wage. I understand that probably. If that was ever taken to court, it's just like SB 7, it wouldn't stand up. But I think it's important for the charter to have it in here and for us to abide by it. One of the things I wanted to talk about was the recommendations on the thing, and Steve changed the wording and clarified it. Thank you, because I was concerned that we were the staff or the council was going to direct the staff to place the to says to proceed with the process of placing the charter on the ballot. And I was concerned about doing that tonight when we've got another public hearing coming, because it sounds like we're already saying that this is what we're going to do. And I don't think it's legal to do that without the other public hearing. Steve did change the wording in that tonight, so that says that it's okay to do that. The section that Tony brought up, one of the reasons that I think that myself, as a committee member, we were trying to make sure that the ordinances and powers rights were established in such a manner that something in the future council couldn't happen like Bell. And I realize what Tony's talking about is having some kind of leeway. You know, that wording probably needs to be changed some. But I want to be real careful in one, just remove the last sentence, including but not limited to the compensation rates to be paid by the performance of such work. If we would remove that, then that would remove all reference to wages from this 301 contract, public works contracts. And then that would allow us to keep that intact. And then we could remove 302, and we wouldn't even need 307. So, and I hate to lump 301 in with 302, because there are several things in there that are important, and I think that we need them. So by taking that out, reference to the wages, that section, public works section, can be left in there. And I think the city attorney kind of referred to that a little earlier. In the last sentence there, it says the city also contracted with other public agencies for construction works and public improvement. I'd really like to know what other public agencies are, because CMC is probably a public agency. And does that mean we can bring prisoners in here and work for 50 cents an hour on projects? Just a crazy example. But to say all public agencies, I think it concerns me a little bit just what that means. So, in closing, I would like to see the city council in the recommendations for tonight, if I can find it. Sorry. In the alternatives, if we would propose the draft without the prevailing wage section and place the prevailing wage clause as a separate measure on a ballot at a subsequent election, not on the ballot with the same charter, because I think that having two votes on the same ballot over this, I think would be confusing. And if we would use four and strike out that to put it on a subsequent ballot after the ruling of SB 7. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, John. Anyone else would like to come forward?
Good evening, Barbara Harmon. I reside at 216 South Mason Street. I just wanted to emphasize that I think it's important that the city charter draft would not prohibit or preclude requirements to pay prevailing wage on public work projects. It would provide council the authority to make the determination instead of state legislature. It would provide increased flexibility to the city on prevailing wage requirements to ensure projects are constructed in the most cost-effective manner and in the best interest of our city. I really encourage everyone, before you make any decision or draw any more conclusions, to really read the draft. It's very comprehensive. It answers a lot of questions. And again, it does not preclude the requirements to prevail, to pay the prevailing wage. And thank you.
Okay, thank you. You're going to have to walk faster.
Okay. Sometimes towards the end is better. Good evening, Mayor, Council, staff. I've had the privilege of seeing some of you before. Some of you, this is my first time. My name is Cherie Cabral. I work for the California State Building and Construction Trades Labor Management Trust. So that being said, that long acronym simply means that I work on behalf of and for workers that are members of the State Building and Construction Trades affiliates throughout the entire state of California, and also all of the contractors who are signatory to those, so large and small in between. Take the big ones as large as Bechtel all the way down to some of the folks that maybe here are in your local neighborhood. I also stand before you as a former city council member. So a couple of the comments I want to make tonight are not only on governance, but also on public contract code and how the bid process works. I managed public works construction for 10 years of my life, building schools, airports, county-owned hospitals, fire stations, civic centers, libraries, you name it. So one of the things I would like to kind of bring to your attention, and it's been alluded to already, that is that public contract requires that you take the lowest, not the most expensive liability that you have towards you is twofold. It is litigation and rework. So even if somebody is paying their workers rock bottom price, if you've got to do it twice, the price did not double, the price just tripled. Because you have to have oversight from staff, you have to have legal counsel to go through the whole process, and you've got to start over and you have to factor in how much time it took. You do not need a charter to put those pieces into play. You can do that independently. You can also change the way that you look at and what you expect from your final delivery methods. You can do CM at risk, you can do design build, you can do design assist. You have a number of avenues at your disposal that do not require you to change your entire governance structure, simply to look at whether or not you feel somebody is a responsible bidder. That being said, I don't know how to stress this enough, in that it's really interesting and fairly ironic to me that the conversation is being had on how you structure an entire systematic change to your governance structure here in your community and asking your voters to approve that. Wipe the slate clean, start over, recraft your entire structure of governance, open yourself up to a certain amount of liability in doing so, simply so that you can do two things which happen to be polar opposite. You want to put provisions in that allow you to double down on what you already have here in policy, which is to hire locally through your contractors, which is a local bid preference. But then you want to somehow or another maybe sacrifice prevailing wage, just maybe kind of hoping that SB 7 tanks and you can get away with doing it. But when you do that, the people that live here, that have businesses here, whose workers are here, that have to be able to make a high enough wage to afford to live in this community and pay their taxes to this community, shop in this community, buy cars in this community, send their kids to school in this community, aren't going to be the ones that are working on your jobs because they can't take those wages and afford to live here. So the only contractors that are going to come in, your predominant number of contractors that are going to come in, are going to be from somewhere else where the cost of living is lower and their workers can survive on that, which means that your hardworking community members here who have paid you property taxes, gas taxes, sales taxes, you're sending their tax money home to another community to support that other community. You are not fostering your own economic development here at home. So from somebody who is a former city council member and knows just how limited those dollars really are, and once you run out of them, how hard it is to get them back or expand them, that's a pretty risky proposition. The other part is interestingly enough, I haven't heard anybody tell you this, but prevailing wage is what was called Little Davis-Bacon. Davis-Bacon is the federal provision. The federal provision was brought in the late 1800s by two Republican individuals. It was not brought in to protect the workers. It was brought in to protect the contractors. Because at the end of the Civil War, you had contractors coming into the North where wages were higher in a more industrialized area. They were coming from the South in a more agrarian area. They were bringing in lower paid workers, and the contractors were undercutting the contractors from the northern side and putting the local contractors out of business. So I would encourage you to think about that. And at the very time that there is arguments going on, bipartisan arguments, mind you, about whether to raise the minimum wage, whether to leave it where it is, and you have Republicans, staunchly anti-union Republicans, that are buying into this discussion over potentially raising the prevailing wage, or the minimum wage, whether you agree with the proposition or not. The argument behind it is, if you pay somebody what they're worth and they have a wage that they can afford to live on, which is what prevailing wage is, then they are less dependent on public assistance and public subsistence, which translates into you're not paying with your tax dollars twice. You're going to pay once with your tax dollars for the cost of that worker. If you're paying a low wage, you're going to pay twice, because those people are going to be using food stamps, public assistance. They're going to be using the county medical hospitals for their health care, which means you're paying it anyways. So I'd really ask you to consider if those changes are really worth, you know, what you're ultimately trying to accomplish. So thank you for your consideration. I hope you all have a wonderful evening.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Anyone else?
Mr. Mayor, City Council, my name is Alan Buck. I'm the Executive Director of the Five Cities Community Service Foundation. I debated about coming up here, I'll have to admit. Varda Keita, you know, one of our board members, also one of your advisory committee members, asked me to just step in and kind of give you a little update on what's going on with the rec center itself, and then talk a little bit about how we've analyzed prevailing wage versus non-prevailing wage kind of thing in our cost estimates. The rec center project basically has been revitalized by some younger people than us board people that have been on the board and what have you. So we've got some new interest in there. We've asked of this multi-stage design. We figured that with the forecourts and everything, but no second story configuration like we had, we would probably cost about $4 to $5 million. And since we've got $1.6 million in the bank already, that's a little more realistic figure for us. And without prevailing wage, we just determined through various contractors that have given us information to us that we could reduce that cost by about $600,000. Now, the other design that we had before, the 50,000 square foot design, that was a $14 million project that you approved back in 2010 with a CDA. The total cost there, like I said, was $14 million, but we were working through various sources, and we determined that prevailing wage would save us, well, would cost us another $2 million, which is pretty substantial on a project that size. So, again, we're just looking at these things so that we know, since we're going to try to raise all the money completely for this project and build it for you and then give it to you kind of thing, that we want to look at both of these. We're not stating whether we're for or against it, but whatever you decide to do with your status and changing to a charter city, we hope it'll help us raise some money for this event, this project. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Anyone else?
Good evening, Mayor, Council Members, staff. I wasn't planning on coming up here. My name's Steve Lieberman, and I, too, am a former council member. Had the pleasure of working with several of you when I served with Grover Beach. You know, I went through a similar process in Grover Beach, and I think just to keep things in perspective, I mean, I'm all about political reality. But the other part is, when I had folks from coming in from Sacramento into 2.25 square mile Grover Beach to my little volunteer committee meetings, it reinforced something that was really important to me when I was new on the Grover Beach Council, and that was local control. It was fighting for Proposition 1A. When Sacramento was shifting, which is a really fancy way of stealing money from our local economies, we worked really hard to pass Proposition 1A. Unfortunately, the governor found a workaround, and the thievery continued after the successful passage. You need to make some tough decisions this evening. Again, there's real issues. People have been very clear with you about whether they would support or oppose any measure. But I truly believe that we folks on the Central Coast can best govern ourselves. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Anyone else? Last call. I knew I could get one more.
Good evening. Donnie Williams, president of the Kern and Yamuno Central Labor Council. I reside in Bakersfield, but I bring my family over to the Central Coast as many times as possible because it's a beautiful community. We've attended several of your festivities here, your Strawberry Festival, to be one. And it's nice to have a clean city, a well-kept city, looked upon by union labor. My question to you as elected officials is, who brought this idea to your attention? Was it a rank-and-file city resident? Was it your staff? Or was it a third-party interest, such as the ABC, that would have a stake in how you run your local government? We have heard tonight that there is volunteerism. Volunteerism is great, but you've got to look at the downside of volunteerism. Liability. How hard does everybody work and pay their taxes, and then an unforeseen accident, such as one of your public events, that you had labor, unskilled labor, provide a service that would injure a community member? I wouldn't want that to wish that on anybody, but I will tell you, having come from a family that have had a background of union labor, gone through the apprenticeship programs, provided training and everything, compared to unskilled labor, I will tell you, OSHA has conducted many investigations, and they have found that there are far less injuries when there is union labor on the job. Unskilled labor, it's unsurmountable. There are more injuries in cities across this great state and nation where there is unskilled labor, non-union labor, do shoddy work, and guess who has to come back and mop it up? The union labor. So I would encourage you to...
Our public hearing portion of 9A, and we're going to bring this matter back to the council. And we'll start to my right with Council Member Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Well, it's important to focus on what we're trying to do here tonight. We're talking about whether or not we're going to go for a city charter, and it's not whether we're going to, you know, we're going to dictate that this happens. It's whether or not we're going to put this to a vote of the people to have the citizens of Royal Grande decide this. There have been a lot of issues brought up tonight, and I'll focus on a couple of them here. First thing, I think that, you know, the issue of salaries to council was brought up in the past. We already have the right legal authority to raise our salaries if we wanted to, but we haven't for at least 15 years, so the issue of charter does not have anything to do with that. The issue of the mail-in ballots and other electronic voting systems for special elections is a big plus to me. I think that that's a very big positive and one of the reasons why I think we should go forward with putting this on the ballot and letting people vote on it. I see both sides of the argument about the looking down line at whether or not we provide the council with the ability to have a little more flexibility to deal with issues as they come forward, and I'm willing to listen to what my colleagues have to say about that. I don't know that we necessarily want to cut ourselves off from that with the language that's in there, but I'll hear what my colleagues have to say. I think we do want to keep the door open to that to some extent. The issue of public works contracts. Now, we're going to keep public works contracts following the California Public Contract Code and its standards, except that there will be some possible exemptions to that, where we produce our own standards. And the issue was brought forward earlier that one of the people that addressed this talked about the contracting process as a means of selecting the right people. You don't always have to go with the low bidder, and I think that's something that's important that we need to keep in mind as we go forward, that if we establish the proper criteria, that's going to allow us to select the proper contractor, the proper bidder when a project comes forward. I'm in favor of dropping the line in Article 3, Section 301, Subset I, the last part of the sentence, including but not limited to the compensation rates to be paid for the performance of such work. I think we should take that out. We get to the issue of prevailing wage, and I've been a union member for 25 years, two different unions, and unions have a place, and it's good to have unions. Certainly there are some abuses, but it's good to have unions. Unions serve a purpose. But the issue of prevailing wage, if we go to the charter city concept the way it's presented in the draft, we're not saying we're doing away with prevailing wage. What we're saying is that we're going to use prevailing wage, applying whenever it's legally required, whether it's constitutionally permitted to be imposed, when it's required by federal or state grants pursuant to federal or state law, and anytime we're going to have federal or state dollars, we're going to be using prevailing wage. So we're not going to eliminate prevailing wage on those issues. And in terms of any time the city council does not consider the project to be a municipal affair, we may not consider it to be a municipal affair, but if it's a state or federal project or we're using state or federal dollars, prevailing wage is still going to be there. So I don't see the issue of having a charter city go forward as eliminating prevailing wage. Certainly we're going to have some flexibility with prevailing wage, but this is not eliminating prevailing wage. I don't think we want to eliminate prevailing wage. So I will support this tonight. Section 7307, depending on SB 3, fine. Well, whatever happens with the legality of that, we'll deal with it as it comes forward. But I will support putting this on the ballot and letting the people of the city vote for this. I will strike that one line that I mentioned. I think that comes out. And I'm willing to hear what my colleagues have to say about the issue of the line in Section 100 under municipal affairs.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Councilmember Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Or for it, either side of the coin. And I'm very disappointed with some of the misinformation I've already heard tonight and some of the stuff I've gotten in the mail. Very distressing. So I want to bring that up. The other thing I want to bring up going forward, I'm hoping, Steve, in one of the next meetings we have Karen Ray brought up a question to you when you put up a slide during one of our early presentations about what percentage of dollars and what kind of dollars were we talking about that actually ended up being public works versus prevailing wage, versus non-prevailing wage. And I think that going forward, to crystallize for the public, we need to be able to show that kind of detail in some format. And you had a slide that showed that to some degree, and I'd like to see that again going forward. And I thought Karen's question was a really good one, and that's the public should understand what the percentage of projects really are prevailing wage versus non. I am for getting rid of the language that we originally were going to put in as a safety valve, because I'm convinced that we have enough other language to protect the citizens that we won't have some of the things that went on in Bell and maybe other places. So that first paragraph that the mayor mentioned, I'm all for taking out. I'm assuming Section 401 has to do with unfunded mandates. That's what it reads to me. Is that correct, Steve? Section 401 that John Keene brought up that has to do with unfunded mandates?
That is correct.
Yeah, I'm all for that, and I think John brought up a really valid point there. Again, this is one of those things we're going to put in front of the voters, and whatever they do, I'll be quite happy with one way or the other. In one of my past lives, I spent a year with a local developer trying to build private, affordable housing for the low-income folks in our area, workforce housing, and there was a lot of state money involved that we could have gotten at one particular year. And I was naive, I think, in thinking that we were going to be able to get these things built. What I found out afterward was, because of prevailing wage, none of the projects that we came forward with could go forward from a private standpoint. And this gentleman, I pushed him hard to do this type of housing where he was normally doing higher-end income housing for the area, and I'm trying to get farm worker housing, I'm trying to get, you know, minimum wage type housing for people, and with prevailing wage, it just didn't pencil, plain and simple. So I understand all the arguments about good work and good training. I'm in the workers' comp field. I totally understand that argument. But we have a fiduciary responsibility to the citizens to do things in a financially responsible manner. And part of that, I think, means that we have the flexibility and we're not mandated by the state what we need to pay on a certain project, because it's going to kill certain projects going forward. It just will. And anybody that doesn't believe that is not being intellectually honest. So those are my comments, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Thank you. Councilmember Barnage.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I too am ready to move forward with placing this on the ballot in November. I think Joe and Tim mentioned, definitely I am concerned about the Section 100. At first I thought it was a good thing, but the mayor brought up a point that made me think that maybe we should sort of rework that language. I think it really backs us into a corner. And then regarding the Section 301, I'm also in agreement with removing that last sentence that refers to the wages that John Keene brought up. I'm really leaning towards alternative number four, which is having these go separately on the ballot on a subsequent ballot after the ruling of SB 7, the prevailing wage part of it. I can see both sides, definitely. There's going to be good union workers that are responsible and do great work, and there's lots of non-union workers that I know that do great work. And so I think going forward, that's really something to think about. So it can really go both ways. I really think it can. Again, do away with it. So I think that's an important decision that the voters should make, and that's the way I'm leaning right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem.
As always, going later in the discussion means a lot of the things that you had in mind to say have already been said, but I'll say in general, I certainly am prepared to go forward with the charter amendment. I do think that there are, independent of prevailing wage, there are significant advantages to the city, and there may be even significant advantages down the road. Unfunded mandates were mentioned as a possibility. As a small city, we're never going to be in a position that if an unfunded mandate came down, that we would go out and litigate it and do what we needed to do. But some of our big brothers might, and we would enjoy the benefits of that. So I do think that there are going to be there may be significant advantages down the road in dealing with the state and being a charter city versus not being a charter city. That's notwithstanding the unending creativity of our legislature to find different ways of doing this and making us litigate over years and years the same thing over and over. So but I do think that the other advantage, even the direct advantages, while we do have some flexibility in the way that we award contracts, we have far more flexibility under the as a charter city. I agree with eliminating the one piece of language to deal with the confusion between the two sections. My problem here has to do with this is putting the prevailing wage in the hands of the council. I agree with the comments so far that, in fact, the vast majority of contract work in the city will, in fact, be under prevailing wage because the vast majority of it is funded by state and federal funding. It's this relatively small segment where we might be working with a partner like the people who are building the basketball court, where we would need the flexibility, where we would be looking for that kind of flexibility in order to make that possible, because $2 million is a lot of money. It's about, I think, 17% of that total funding. My problem here with the city council making this decision is that, one, we're just pushing the decision down the road. We're placing the city council, we're politicizing this particular issue. We're doing two things. One is we're going to have the council have exactly this meeting right here all over again, and all over again maybe every 2 years. Every time there's an election, there could be a new decision. And I think that prevailing wage is an important enough decision that the citizens should make that decision. So I'm in favor of splitting the decision here, taking this provision out and putting prevailing wage specifically in front of the voters. I think we should do it at the same time. I understand the logic that there's some confusion because it may be legal now and it may not be legal, but I really think that this is a decision that's kind of made as a cohesive decision. It's not splitting it in half. Looks, frankly, to me, looks shady. Let's get the charter, and then let's go deal with prevailing wage. Let's deal with them both up front. Let's get one decision. Let's put it all in front of the. I think our citizens are perfectly capable of making this decision, and that the inconsistency of putting it in as a council decision is twofold. As I said, it could change from year to year, but also we have a tendency to create awkward policies. You know, where we're trying to bend it to fit some special interest who was there that night, who raised some question, and then we bend the policy. And I'm looking at the city attorney because he hates these kinds of things. So then we end up a year and a half later trying to interpret this policy, and it's got this weird little bend in it that we were trying to accomplish something on that night. I think this is something we should decide straight up. It's either we're either going to include prevailing wage for all municipal activities, or we're not. And I really think it should be all decided on a single ballot and not split in half. So that's I would be in favor of alternative four, with them happening on the same ballot is the direction that I would like to go. I will say that I'm not going to stand in the way of supporting this over that particular issue. But I think we would be much better off to do it that way than as proposed in two separate ballots. Well, yeah, we'll decide the prevailing wage issue either as a council at a future decision or on the ballot box. So I won't debate the prevailing wage issue. I just think it's far more complicated than it was presented tonight, and on both sides of the issue. But I do think that our electorate is perfectly capable of making this decision. In fact, if I didn't think they were capable of making this decision, I'd be hesitant to be a charter city, because at some point bad things could happen, and we have to depend on our citizenry, and I know the citizenry will step forward and do what they need to do. We'll never be Bell, because we won't even get close to that.
We can do that, but that is our recommendation.
Okay. So we will have an addition to the draft, and I like the language. I think it's it should be in there, and I'm conscious of the fact that we sort of allude to it in other areas of the existing charter, but this is a good succinct statement, and for the benefit of those who don't have it in front of you, it's Article 7 amendments. Any proposal for the amendment, revision, or repeal of this charter or any portion thereof may be proposed by majority vote of the City Council or by initiative, and let me underscore the word propose, because I think that's what you meant, John. can be proposed by the majority vote of the city council or by initiative of the people of the city of Aurora Grandy, but no such proposal shall be effective until approved by a majority vote of the voters. So that's the clarification that I think it's valuable for that to be in there. We can propose a change, but we can't finalize it without the vote of the community. I'm happy to hear the remarks with regard to the language relative to municipal affairs. And once again, I can understand why it's in there. We want to make sure, obviously, through the public education process, but the underlying theme of this has to be based on the fact that the council's going to do the right thing relative to the charter. So it falls back on the charter that has been said in so many different ways. This is our constitution. Once it's set, it's set. So if we put in limiting language such as this particular clause, then that essentially ties our hands. And I'm happy that at least some members of the public understand that. And I think through a good public education and outreach program, more will understand as well. I understand why it's there, but I would much rather focus on outlining the abuses. And all of us are very sensitive to that, given the recent history with the city of Bell and Vernon and all of those other cities down there. Nobody wants to go there. And I know that many of you realize that there, even if there are good laws in place, if there are bad people administering those laws, then you're going to have the kinds of abuses that you see down in the city of Bell. And that's what we're experiencing. And just to put a period on that, I think the city manager down there just pleaded guilty to about 7 or 8 different felony counts, and it's going to be a while before he sees the light of day. And I think several of the other administrators, as well as the elected officials down there, are going to follow suit. So I will tell you this, as I indicated at the beginning during the questioning period, that we do expect the legislature to continue on with their infringement on municipal affairs. They have already established that pattern in dealing with the kind of the special interests up there that are getting primed for the next session. We expect a number of issues to come back, and we expect the legislature to act on those. Many of those will be become state law, but will be short of a constitutional amendment, which means if we remain a charter city, we're going to be subject to them. And the medical marijuana issue is one of them. So they are going to come back to us. So I would much rather not try and encompass every potential thing that the legislature might do embodied in our charter and then have them come off the wall with something that we didn't think of and not be able to take action on it. So I would like to see us do our best job at detailing some of the abuses and putting limitations on those, as we have salaries, taxes, and all of the other things that traditionally or historically have been targets of abuse. There's been talk about separating out the prevailing wage provisions, and I believe that the language that's in here now, with perhaps a few slight modifications, can address the issue of prevailing wage, should we or should we not apply it to projects. The more likely you are to have confusion, the more likely you are to have to work extra hard during the public education and the outreach process. I think our voters get it, and if we focus and highlight the prevailing wage issue as it would exist if it were embedded as it is in this measure or draft measure, I think through the public education process, we're going to be okay. The last thing I want to say is, and I appreciate all of the public comment tonight. I think all of us have been at one time or another members of a union. And so I think, as far as I'm concerned, this is not a, quote, union issue. And it shouldn't be. And I know that there are differing opinions here, and that's fine. But all of us have those individual experiences, and all of us sit here representing, I think, a kind of a higher profile issue. And that is, it isn't our experience. It's not what's benefited us. It's what's good for the city from an administrative standpoint and from a fiscal standpoint. That's how we have to evaluate this. So I'm in favor of keeping the prevailing wage language embedded in the measure, and I think we can do a good job through public education. And that kind of segues into a point that I want to make, and several of my colleagues have touched on it. There's no other way to do this but to illustrate it. And what I'd like to do is, if you can you turn the overhead on? I want to put that piece that I gave you up. I want to talk about public education, and I want to talk about putting forth accurate information on both sides. Okay, so just look at the top of it. What have local politicians been doing behind closed doors? Flip it over, if you would, Kelly. Secret charter meetings leave Central Coast taxpayers off the agenda. Now, I'm not here to talk about any other city. I'm not here to talk about what other people have or have not done. But clearly, through the course of this evening's discussion, began very early in the meeting, where we awarded certificates of appreciation to members of our citizen advisory committee. I want to talk about that. those meetings were public, as most of you, if not all of you in the audience, know. They were noticed publicly. Public was given access, and public spoke. Some of you, I'm sure, probably spoke at those meetings. They were not held behind closed doors. They were not secret charter meetings. But yet, that is the kind of information that was mailed to every citizen in Arroyo Grande. So if that's the tenor of where we're going with this, then it's unfortunate. I would much rather, and I'm addressing those of you who spoke on behalf of unions in here, and the prevailing wage issue, and you raised some good points. You came at it from the standpoint of having that prevailing wage turn around and benefit the community in several different ways. You made some good points. All I'm asking for is that as we move forward, however the public education and outreach takes shape on both sides, that that we don't see this kind of thing going out to our public, put forth something that really makes the case for what you want to, the message that you want to get across. Say some of the things that you said this evening in front of us. We don't need to go there. So so anyway, that's the point that I wanted to make in terms of public outreach and education. I've already talked about SB 7. I think that this issue, one way or the other, is going to be resolved sooner rather than later, based on the momentum that is gathering. The previous Supreme Court decision that was rendered in the Vista case, many of the justices that decided that case are still on the bench. If another measure comes to them very similar in its orientation, I suspect they're going to make a decision fairly quickly. Someone wants to put in there or give it a try.
Mr. Mayor, I'll go forward. I move we direct staff to proceed with the process of placing a charter measure on the ballot at the election to be held on November 4th by scheduling an additional public hearing, appropriating $10,000 for public education efforts, but making the changes that we eliminate. I think I can live with eliminating the language in Section 100, line 5, beginning with provided, and then with general law cities. Eliminate that line. And in Section 301, sub I, eliminate the language beginning with including, but not limited to, the compensation fees, rates to be paid for the performance of such work. And adding in the language that John Keane brought forward about Article 7, 700, the amendment, including the language, any proposal for the amendment, revision, or repeal of this charter, or any portion thereof may be proposed by majority vote of the City Council or by initiative by the people of the City of Royal Grandy. No such proposal shall be effective until approved by a majority vote of the voters voting in an election on the question and until filed with the Secretary of State in the State of California. In the event of any conflict between this section and Article 11, Section 3 of the California Constitution may be amended, the latter shall govern. And I will leave intact the language in Section 302 regarding prevailing wage.
Okay, inside the ballot, not a separate ballot.
Inside the ballot, not a separate ballot. Okay.
We have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
All right. Any discussion?
Just a minor clarification. For purposes of internal consistency, Section 307, excuse me, also refers to Section 301. That was before we made the change to eliminate the wording relevant to payment. So I would recommend that we strike the two references to Section 301 and Section 307, so we'll only be referring to Section 302.
That's fine. Motion stands.
Second hold.
All right. Discussion?
Additional comment. I want resolution here, so I am going to support this evening. I do think we probably would still be better off with a separate vote on this specific. But when you read this language over, it is very limited in the scope that we are going to actually be making decisions on prevailing wage. So, but I do still have concerns about politicizing those decisions week after week or every 2 years. But I will support this as going forward because I do think we need finality on this.
Well, in continuing discussion on this, if I read this correctly, it says that the council shall establish criteria and guidelines for determining when payment of prevailing wages will apply to any contract. I think we can arrive at that and come up with a set of standards that will stand and not need to be revisited for every project.
Well, if you keep on reading it, it says the prevailing wages, whenever the prevailing wage is legally required, constitutionally permitted to be,
and they're going to be there most of the time.
Which certainly, you know, it's going to be there anyway, required by federal or state grants. The real key part of this is the city does not consider the project to be a municipal affair.
But even when it does not even when the council does not consider a project to be a municipal affair, if we have federal or state dollars involved, it doesn't matter. It's still going to hold.
The other ones supersede, but these will be the controversial decisions.
Okay, any other discussion? Okay, hearing none, roll call, please.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnidge?
No.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay, moving on, our second public hearing, 9B, is consideration of a proposed ordinance prohibiting dogs at the Soto Sports Complex. John, good evening.
The financial impact of the proposed ordinance would be very low, $360 for signage, which would be placed at all the facility entrances. There, in addition, there would be minimal staff costs involved associated with public education and with what would be anticipated as minimal enforcement needs for this. As far as background goes, the Soto Sports Complex is open for reserved activities from March through December. It accommodates mostly local youth sports activities with some adult sports activities. And it was built with the priority being given to youth sports activity, local youth sports groups. Currently, the youth sports group that utilize the facility include the Arroyo Grande Valley Little League, Arroyo Grande Babe Ruth, AYSO Youth Soccer, Central Coast Condors Youth Soccer, Five Cities Girls Softball, and Five Cities Youth Football League. This is the most heavily used facility in the city. I'm sure if you've gone by there on any weekend, especially in the spring and summer, you've seen that the parking lots are packed, and even the residential neighborhoods around there are affected by the use of this facility. Approximately 5,000 youth and adults participate in or attend activities at this facility each year, and that includes more than 50,000 user hours at the facility. The sports complex is used approximately 290 days each year, and that often includes 7 days a week. So you can see it's a very heavily used facility. So anything that impacts the users at this facility obviously is significant with the amount of use that it has. There has been an increase in the number of people who bring dogs to the sports facility, and I would say that, you know, that's a reflection of society in general. There's an increase in the amount of people who bring dogs lots of different places, including the facility. But what that does at this facility is it results in an increase in dog-related issues. excuse me. There's been an increase in the number of dog-related incidents at the Soto Sports Complex over the last 5 years, and that's led to concerns for public safety and presents a genuine liability risk for the city. Staff has received verbal reports from staff and user groups over the past 5 years, witnessing many instances of dogs fighting, chasing and scaring children, barking that frightens spectators and disrupts their enjoyment of the games, people tripping over leashes, children knocked off of the banks at the basin fields onto the cement pads below, dogs allowed to run off leash, dogs urinating and defecating in areas that children then go and play on, even sometimes immediately after. Due to the increase in the number of dogs, there's been an increase in, of course, in the corresponding urinating and feces on the playing areas and the adjacent areas. And this presents a serious health risk due to bacteria and parasites that are carried, you know, by some dogs. It also presents an increased issues for maintenance staff, some of which are very unpleasant, you know, in dealing with this increase. I would also just like to add that besides the users of the groups that actually use the field for sporting purposes, there are some local neighbors that also like to use some of the fields to run their dogs. That's an added issue that isn't that adds to the issues that are problems at the field. There is in order to address the issue of accommodating people who would like to run their dogs, the off-leash dog park was built 3 years ago as a alternative for people to go ahead and let their dogs run off-leash, and that is in a very close proximity to the field, so it could accommodate those needs. Other California cities have experienced the same health and safety-related issues and have adopted similar ordinances, and in some cases, much more stringent ordinances. What we're really talking about here is that gathering large groups of people together and cheering and excited crowds is not a real appropriate place to have dogs mixing with them, because the dogs will naturally at times do what dogs do, whether that's fight, bark, you know, defecate in the field, all those issues that dogs just do being dogs. If the ordinance is passed, in addition to signage of the fields, we propose to pass out information to all user groups of the sports facility to educate them on the ordinance and to nearby residents. I would like to tell them the dog ended up knocking the child off of the bank at a Aketa field, and the child fell on his head, injuring himself. And
was the city held liable for that?
No, but certainly that is a serious safety issue. And, you know, again, I would defer to the city attorney on the amount of risk that any of those types of problems, you know, may expose the city to.
And then my other question is there any city within the county that has a current ordinance like this right now?
There's not.
Those are all my questions, Mr. Mayor.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
I do have a question. I'll follow that up and maybe toss a question at the attorney. Given that we had a situation where a child was knocked down and we weren't held responsible, let's hypothetically say we do put this ordinance in place. Should an incident occur and we have not enforced the ordinance, we're still going to be held liable, but does this offer us any real protection?
There's not a significant amount of liability associated with this issue, candidly. Either way, there's not a significant amount of liability. To me, it's a health and safety issue. It's not really a liability issue. Although there's obviously liability in that people tend to sue for anything and everything. In terms of the actual underlying liability at the end of the rainbow, after you've paid attorney's fees, it's insignificant.
Thank you.
Okay. Sorry, any other questions? All right. This is a public hearing, and once again, I'd invite members of the public to come forward and comment on this item if you so desire.
Hello, my name is Christina Bradbury, and I am here to support the petition to prohibit all dogs from the Soto Sports Complex. I have three children who currently play for Five Cities Girls Softball and AG Valley Little League. And during the spring season, between practices and games, these fields become a second home to us. I am a current dog owner, and I treat her as she is another member of my family. However, from past experiences, I feel dogs should not be allowed at these fields. I have seen other families who are extremely afraid and uncomfortable around dogs. I have seen players who are extremely distracted by them while their coaches are trying to gain their full attention. I have also seen safety concerns with people tripping over dog leashes or dogs themselves, which could lead to possible serious injuries. My biggest concern is that my two oldest children are highly competitive in these sports, and they dive and rove around in these on this grass. So therefore, it's very unnerving to me what they might be rolling into. It is also very unhealthy and unsanitary as well. I do have a letter from another member who was unfortunately unable to come tonight because he fell ill, and he has asked me if I could read this letter to you. Dear City Council, I understand there is a petition underway to restrict pets from the fields to used by our Five Cities girls softball teams, and wanted to voice my personal support as a coach and a 5CGS board member. I have been a coach now for several seasons in the 5CGS program and have experienced the problem firsthand on several occasions. It is a distraction and a safety risk when one of our players is running around in the outfield and slips or stumbles on a dog dropping. It is my personal feeling that these fields should be restricted to athletic use only, and that the petition makes sense from a safety and best use perspective. Best regards, Tom Costa. Thank you for your time. Have a good night.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Anyone else who would like to come forward on this item?
My name is Joseph Farino. I live on North Elm. I didn't come to the meeting tonight to speak on this, but I hadn't heard, is there an exception for guide dogs and other working dogs in this law?
Yes, that's written into the ordinance.
Thank you.
Okay, anyone else? All right, seeing none, we will close the public hearing portion of 9B. We'll bring this back to the council. This time we'll start on my left with Councilmember Barnage.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'm ready to support this tonight. I think it's a good idea. I, too, am a dog owner, and I've actually been at the field during ASO soccer games where I think they have signs that say that dogs are prohibited, but people still brought the dogs. And literally twice I can remember dogs were running through the field as games were being played.
You know, we'll continue to do what they do. Maybe that means self-policing, maybe that means better education, but this just seems to me like I have to look at it from a liability standpoint. Number one, there is no liability issue. Health standards, we can't wrap our kids in cotton and protect them from everything. Kids go out and play, they get involved with, they go to school around other sick kids, put in situations that aren't always the healthiest, and I think we're being overly concerned here about an issue, and I just can't support the ordinance at this point.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Costello.
I've got a quick question before I make any decision. No, how would we enforce this?
Sorry. The plan that we have would be to educate, because the vast majority of the users are the youth sports groups and the adult sports group, we have direct contact with them. So we plan to educate the people through handouts to them about the ordinance in place. And one of the things that I'd just like to kind of respond, I guess, to Tim's concern is that we have tried education. We've put that on, and as Councilmember Barnage has said, there's signs out there for AYSO that say you can't bring your dog, but they still bring their dog. And unfortunately, because of the increase in the number of dogs, it's also increased that small percentage of dogs and dog owners that don't abide by the rules and aren't good shepherds of their dogs. And no matter how good a dog owner you are or how well-trained a dog you are, at times you're going to defecate or pee or bark at a dog or nip at an ankle, and it's those safety issues that you just can't prevent. As far as enforcement, after self-enforcement, which we believe will be very effective because there will then be an actual ordinance and rule in place, and it will be posted, the enforcement beyond that would be through police citation.
Okay, thank you for the response. I can support this tonight. I can sympathize with what Councilmember Brown is saying. I, too, am a dog owner. We've had dogs for 15 years. But the area we're talking about is intended for youth sports. It's intended for team sports that don't include the animals. We do have the dog park right around the corner. It's going to be there available. We've made an exception for the pathway so people can transit to it. But I don't believe the dogs belong in the field when we're having youth activities going on because of the health issues. I know I clean up an awful lot in my backyard every week from two dogs. And I'll support this. I think that enforcement is probably going to be dependent on peer pressure more than having our police officers out there citing people. I don't think that's going to happen all that often. So I think this is merely going to be an additional tool to maybe reinforce the signs and to reinforce the signs we're going to put up to encourage people not to bring their animals out. So I'll support this tonight.
Okay, thank you. Mayor Pro Tem.
Yeah, I think Councilman Costello hit on kind of the key issue here, and that is that this is not just a regular park. This is, in fact, a sports facility. And I would say even dogs that are on leash and under control and doing their owners are being responsible are, in fact, at the very least, distracting to these sports activities. People tripping over the leash of a dog on a leash, that's a responsible dog owner, but somebody's still on the ground. It may not be an issue yet, but I don't think it's just liability. I think it is actually the functioning of these areas that they function well as a sports facility. So I can support this tonight. I don't think this is, it's not like we're banning dogs from every park in the city. So it's really just this one location where this specific activity takes place. So I can support this.
Okay, thank you. Well, it's been a little while since I've seen one of those sweatshirts, but my daughter played Five Cities softball from the time she was a very little girl until she reached the age restriction. And so I have several anecdotal observations that I can make. And, you know, during that process, my admiration for the coaches that were out there went up measurably for the patience and the restraint that they used. And I recall on a couple of occasions where there was a fly ball hit to center field, and this one little girl was running in. She was almost in position, and then she stopped. But they're in a depression, and so that gives the impression that it's a confined area where you can let your dog run off leash, and that's exactly what this gentleman was doing. Walked his dog down into the impression, cut the leash off, and the dog started running. And you know what happens when dogs start running in an open area. They get excited, and there was no way he was going to police up after that dog. So as far as I'm concerned, this is a measure that is long overdue. I'm going to support it. In terms of how we enforce it, I think we use a little bit of common sense, and we do it progressively. I think the word-of-mouth approach is good. I think flyers are good. I think for the first couple of weeks that this is in place, some park staff needs to be out there. And if somebody shows up, hand them a flyer and a friendly reminder and ask them to please remove the dog. If it keeps up or we have incidents, then, of course, progressive enforcement perhaps goes to the next step. It won't be very long before the word gets out and people will understand where we're trying to go. I will tell you this, having my daughter play All-Stars and having to travel to places like Bakersfield in the dead of summer, a lot of the sports fields there have this same ordinance in place for the very same reasons. So, while there may not be any in this county, I know they do exist elsewhere. So I'm going to support this tonight, and I think it'll be a good thing for us. Now, on the liability issue, it's scary. I'll tell you, all it takes is one. And while that may not be the primary reason why we're doing this, it certainly is a reason. And all it takes is one bad incident, and this can come back and really hurt the city in many different ways. So I'm going to support it. And with that, I'll entertain a motion.
I move approval of an ordinance of the City of Arroyo Grande prohibiting dogs from the Soto Sports Complex.
I'll second that.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
No.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes. All right. We're going to move on to item 11, new business. Consideration of Hoosgow Park Landscape and Accessibility Renovation Project. Good evening again, Jeff.
Mayor Farah, members of the council, Jeff English, Public Works Director, here to talk about an exciting project this evening. It's the renovation plan and ramp accessibility improvements for the Hooskow Park. And I do have a slideshow, and I'll go through it as quickly as I can, but there's in some interesting slides, and we're looking forward to this topic. Tonight, our recommendation is for the council to approve the conceptual plan for the Hooskow Park renovation project and to appropriate $5,000 from the Water Neutralization Fund for the project account for water-conserving irrigation supplies. Hooskow Park is really a hidden gem in our community. It's a small park right up behind the village off of LaPointe. It's highlighted here in red on the map, which is in your packet as well. We did a little history on research on history of the park and came up with some photos. This is an interesting photo. You can actually see in this photo a woman here. Don't know who she is, and nobody can tell me, but that's a Girl Scout troop that was getting a docent-led tour back in the 70s. The Hooskow Park is named after the Hooskow, which is a slang Hispanic term for a jail facility. It literally means justice, and it was the city's first jail, and we believe it was constructed back in the early 1900s. We don't have any specific records on the date that it was constructed. The Historical Society has been very helpful in providing information for us, and I put some information in your packet that they did some research on. It would be a good renovation project for the Rotary Club. And so the Rotary Club jumped on board relatively quickly, as did Arroyo Grande and Bloom, the South County Historical Society, the Mankins Family Foundation, which provided a donation for the park improvements, and obviously the city of Arroyo Grande. We met on several occasions to kick the project off and have a very active and hardworking group of organizers, and have gone through several steps in a public review process. We initially started off by getting a Cal Poly class involved, and the Cal Poly students, landscape architectural students, came up with some very creative designs. And they presented them to the Arroyo Grande and Bloom and some other partners in this effort. And that was presented at a Park and Recreation Commission on June 12th. We also had several other opportunities for public outreach. We went to the Park and Rec Commission again on November 13th with a finalized conceptual plan. The Architectural Review Committee on December 2nd, and then recently we held a special neighborhood meeting where we invited the affected adjacent property owners. When we met with the property owners, they had several concerns. Some of the concerns were maintaining some kind of a visual vegetative screening, potential trespassing from more increased use at the park was a concern of theirs. Dense vegetation may create some security issues where people could hide near their homes. Maintaining the tall existing trees was one of the concerns. Construction noise and the construction impacts on the access driveway. We came up with what we believe were mitigating efforts in each one of those areas, and in the end all of the adjoining neighbors were supportive of this project and are support by either providing letters or they showed up. The plan itself that is in your packet is a little difficult to read and see, so we provided some expanded views of that tonight. But I did want to point out a few of the major features of this project, and also I'm going to ask Mary Hertel to come up. Mary Hertel is a member of Arroyo Grande and Bloom, and she is a landscape designer. And she did kind of the heavy lifting on this project, really synthesizing the comments from the public, some of the design ideas that were presented by the students, and we believe it's a wonderful plan that you'll review tonight. Some of the major renovation components are accessibility improvements. We're proposing to use community development block grant funds to provide a wheelchair accessible ramp. Currently that facility is not accessible, and our goal is to make all of our facilities accessible, and so that will be one of the major components of this renovation project. Turf removal. We're proposing essentially a change in the use of the park from a more active turf area to a more passive type walkway with some benches and landscaping use. And so I want to make sure that the council knows that there will be a really a change in the style of the park. Water conservation using drought-tolerant landscaping. This removing the turf will be significant effort in that regard. The addition of flowering trees and plants, and Mary will present or show some slides that will highlight some of those plant and tree selections. The Huskow building, a kiosk and sign. That facility is mostly locked, and people don't know much about it. So when they go take a look at it, we want to have a nice kiosk that explains what the Huskow is all about. Also preparing some directional signs to try to direct folks from tourists and others from the village up to the park. Although those are not in the design plans, those are part of our project. And then park sign replacement and directional signs, as I mentioned, we're proposing to replace the existing sign with a similar sign to those that we've used in some of our other parks. And then picnic table and stone benches will be included as well. With that,
but this will be all reconfigured and much safer than what we have going right now. This actually will, because of this long the way the grade is, this becomes actually lower than it is right now. So this will, there will be a grade change right through here, and a little retaining wall would be needed to put right there. I want to show you the next slide. Okay, this is the Huskow right here. What we propose is building a, this is a 30-foot patio, 30-foot diameter patio that is, has a stone, a raised fling stone bench around it, much like what is over by the barn. Built exactly the same, in fact, the same style. We're trying to enlist the same person who built that to build it, so there's some consistency. And same with the paths, same type of paths that are over there. They have a concrete curb with a decomposed, stabilized decomposed granite. So this path is a little lower. This one right here is, well, actually, at this point, it's the same grade it's at right now. And same with this one here. It's the same grade that it's at. There's a picnic bench right here, a picnic table, concrete picnic table that we'll purchase that will be, like, colored in the same sort of color as the flagstone. So it won't be gray, it'll be a golden brown or something like that. So it ties in with the flagstone. There'll be signage around here for the Historical Society, or are planning on creating some signage for informational signage that'll be placed near the Huskow. Hopefully we'll be able to open up the doors and have a vignette in there so people can kind of see what it would have been like to have been thrown in the pokey for overnight. There's all this rosemary, everything that's here now will be removed, and we have intentions of putting a lower growing ground cover that spills over the wall. That was a request from the Architectural Review Committee to have it more softer along the edge here. There is a little path right here that is used by probably anybody's trying to make a little shortcut up there, which is fine. I'm not sure if we're going to be able to maintain that or not, because when you take out this patio 30 feet out from the Huskow, it raises, the grade has to be built up. So it might be a little bit too steep right here to maintain that path, but we won't know really until construction time comes. We're also proposing to put a little split rail, low split rail fence along here, just because there is quite a bit of drop between this, the grade right here, and then the top of the wall. So that we just don't want anybody running off the edge of the wall. So that was that. This is what the type of what the flagstone benches and circular patio will look like. That's over by the barn. What is this show? Oh, all through here, actually, all through here are all drought-resistant plants. Colorful, you'll see in a minute with slides-wise. Colorful, interesting. We intend on putting signage on them, also including information about them on the Oregon website. We also intend on, for the public's edification, is talking about how much water we're putting on. So initially, we'll probably have more water. Later, we'll have no water, or some water, or we hand water, but let people know what it really does take to create this. This right here shows, do we have another slide, or is this kind of a new one, Jeff? Back in here, there's a picture of the bench. All back in here, the residents wanted to still have screening, but after our last talk, they really wanted the screening opened up a little more. So at this point, we'll open this up a little bit more along here. This is ceanothus and then some lemonade berry here. Those are the sign. This is Linda started all this. With her idea, she wanted some flowering trees up there. So something pretty to look at up there. So I was on the hunt for flowering trees, and there's a lot of trees that flower in the spring, and there's some trees that flower in the summer, jacarandas, for instance. They're huge. They get a little bit big. I settled on, this is called a gold medallion tree, and there'll be five of them up there. So when you're looking up into the park there, against that oak backdrop, there'll be five of these flowering, maybe you see the next slide, too. It looks a little pale here, but they're, let's go back.
Yeah, only picture of the trees that we have.
Okay. Anyway, this is called Cassia leptophylla. It's a gold medallion tree, and so we thought we'd give it a try. There's a few grown here. There's apparently a very nice one that's in the San Luis Golf Club course. So we'll try it. Okay. Then we've got this is ceanothus in bloom. This is a picture of the shrub that we want to put up as a hedge. This is Rus integrifolia. This is its flowering. This is, I'm sorry these slides are sort of washed out, but this is called Mexican sage, Jerusalem sage. This is lamb's quarters. So anyway, our intent is colorful, pretty, low maintenance, drought resistant, and accessible for a nice accessible park.
And at this point, we want to open this up for council questions and concerns. Mary, if you could stay up and answer any questions of me.
Can I have my pointer back? I know most of you are probably aware of it, but Mary's out there every Saturday morning with Arroyo Grande in bloom and just does tremendous work. And if you're not aware of it, she is the one that designed and was the cracking the whip for the rest of us volunteers when we put together the fire-resistant garden over by the fire station. That was her design. Beautiful. And I think we have I don't want to preempt everyone, but this is another wonderful effort. Thank you. Okay, questions?
Can we make tequila from the agaves?
I don't think they're the right type, unfortunately.
Okay. No questions.
Okay, Kristen?
Yes, I have a question. Jeff, in the staff report on page 4, the neighbor concerns, number 4, talks about all trees. What staff has come up with is the solution is all tall trees to remain except one pepper tree that is entwined with the large oak. We've looked, Scott and I from the Tree Guild have looked at the pepper tree, and we're in agreement that should go. My concern is that the two words tall trees, because as I had talked to Jeff about earlier, there's a lot of oak trees that are there, and some of them are 2 feet tall. And so what I had proposed when I met Jeff up there was that we sort of, I'm not a big believer in just scorching the earth and getting rid of everything and starting from scratch. And so I was hoping, you know, I like the plan. It's a nice plan, and I'm excited to see it go forward. But what I was hoping is sort of a phased approach on just the oak trees, and specifically that perhaps, you know, everyone's going to be clearing everything out, but maybe we could clear everything but the oak trees. And then Scott and I could meet with you and Jeff up there, and we could look at which ones are viable that will have proper form, that will grow into specimen oak trees. Because since they're already there, they're growing, they're healthy. I know it's hard to get oak trees that do well, and they're already there and they're planted. And so I'm not saying that every single sapling up there needs to stay, but I just think there's a benefit to not taking out everything but the tall trees. And it's hard to determine what's tall to me, what's tall to someone else. So I just sort of thought when you were removing everything else, we could maybe just leave those until, you know, just the next weekend, and then we could take a look at it. That's my 2 cents.
I think our intent is to identify those trees that will kind of benefit that hill slope. And so if there are viable oaks, I think we want to preserve those as well. So we'll need to be somewhat careful when we go through and clean those out and just not remove everything. So that was the intent.
And I think you're right. Also, it says very difficult to see what's even up there right now until we start cleaning. So we'll just leave all the oaks and, you know, come back. And,
Okay.
Any other questions?
No, thank you.
Questions? I have a question. Is there going to be any irrigation up there at all?
We'll change everything from overhead sprinklers that's up there now to drip, and then we're going to put on use the controller that uses the computer system that you now have in the city, so we can regulate it.
Well, I'm thinking ahead, and there should be at least a 2-foot by 2-foot planter for our sweet peas.
Well, it's a drought.
I am shocked that you would not show a picture of those up there. But Jeff, can you roll back the slide on the would be the probably southwest corner of the right there. Mary, you talked about the pathway there, and Jeff and I had a little conversation, and I agree it's a little bit too steep maybe to maintain that path, and I'm not really sure what the right-of-way issues are there. I don't know if there are ownership conflicts there or not, but what I was hoping for, and I know when we were up there with the Mankins family, we had talked about the possibility of maybe using the path as kind of an access, but Jeff suggested the same kind of steps that you have integrated into the project over here. So Linda, Sandy, you've been here all night long. Yeah. How about some airtime here? Any comments?
Thank you. My name is Linda Osti, and I am the president of the Pismo Beach Five Cities Rotary Club. Steve Adams and Sandy Lubin have both been presidents of the same club. And over the years, especially for our 100th anniversary, our club built the amphitheater in Pismo Beach at the Dinosaurs Caves. And, of course, you know the Arroyo Grande Club built the gazebo. All the clubs did a major project. Over the years, when Steve's year, we did the YMCA house there in Pismo Beach. And we recently did additional stairs and a fountain, both pedestrian-friendly and dog-friendly, there in Pismo Beach. And we've done projects all the time. But I'd like to come back to Arroyo Grande because I live in Arroyo Grande. Our club is the Pismo Beach Five Cities Rotary Club, so I thought, why not do a project here? One of the ideas behind having the flowering trees is because, again, no one sees that. Even though it's on the Historical Society walking tour, you don't really see the park. But if they had flowering trees, you could identify it a little bit better. Our club also would like to do some of the free work, do work days with the Roy Grandy and Bloom and help clean it out and so on, in addition to a Rotary grant that we're going to help out with. And I hope that you approve it, and I thank you very, very much for your time.
Thank you, Linda. Sandy, anything? No? Okay. All right. We will, anyone else would like to comment? All right. Seeing no one else, then we'll bring it back to the council. And why don't we start with Councilmember Brown?
Well, all I can say after the night we've had, it's always nice to end on a project like this. This is great. To everybody involved, Jeff, all you guys, I appreciate you. I can't tell you how often I walked by there and didn't even realize it was there, and then one day I'm like, whoa. So, yeah, I think if it gets more use, and it's a fantastic, fantastic thing, and the fact that it's using less water, that's great. But mainly the fact that I think it's going to be more usable for the public, that's the biggest benefit, and I know I'll be walking there, so that's great. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Costello.
I'll support this. It's a great idea. A lot of community involvement here. Fantastic. Let's do it.
Okay. Councilmember Barnage.
Yep, ready to move forward. Excited to see it.
All right. Mayor Pro Tem.
Yeah, me too. I think this is actually a great vista point that a lot of people will appreciate in the long run. One of the few places with some altitude in the village. Thank you.
I'll make it unanimous. I really would like us to take a look at that other access and maybe come up with some concept drawings. And then also, coming back to what Councilmember Barnage was saying a moment ago, and you know, if we can strike a balance with preserving some of those oak trees, but I like the tree selection in terms of the color and having that whole area, you know, come alive with some color, I think is what we want up there. So I don't want to lose that. So with that, I'm ready for a motion.
Mr. Mayor, I'd move approval of the conceptual plans for Huskow Park, along with appropriation of $5,000 from the Water Neutralization Fund for water-conserving irrigation supplies.
Okay, we have motion. Second. Discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnage?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes. Item 12 is council communication. Any questions, clarifications, announcements, observations, anything? Okay. Staff communications, anything, Steve? Our final community comments and suggestions. If there's any member of the public would like to come forward on any item, whether it's on the agenda or not.
John? John King, 298 North Elm Street.
Pull that mic up a little bit, John. There you go.
Because of some water usage abuses in my neighborhood, I was questioning what could be done about it, and I kind of understand that there's no enforcement until we declare stage one drought thing. I think that that's not appropriate yet, but I think that we need to have some way to handle some abuses so that we don't get to that. I go out and get my paper every morning, and every morning there's water running down my curb. Now,
more mindful of your watering frequency or something to that effect. We can work that up.
We have some minor things on, but we just met, 2 days ago? Jeff coordinated the meeting to kind of update our strategies given the situation right now. And so we are stepping up significantly our public education. We are going to be stepping up our enforcement. And by enforcement, it's mostly warnings, doorknob tags, those kind of things. We won't be issuing citations yet, but we'll be doing a lot more canvassing and notifications of violators. And then we're looking at some of our incentive programs, and we'll probably be coming to you fairly soon with some increased recommended increases in the incentives to get more participation. So we have a whole comprehensive plan to get this thing kind of jacked up again and increased.
So there was staff communication after all, see? Okay. And just for everybody's benefit, I drove up to Lopez the other day, and yesterday, as a matter of fact, they are officially at 57%. So about the only good thing about that is the fishing. So, the pool is getting smaller. All right. Any other community comments and suggestions? That takes us to item 15, which is closed session. We have none this evening. And item 16 is adjournment. Thank you very much, everyone, for getting us through this agenda. Much appreciated. And we are adjourned.